G'day, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Heather Mackin.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Mackin.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gasheri, and you're listening to Not the Foolish.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show, our first of 2019. A very happy new year to you all, and let's hope it is a sporting year to remember. I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
John, good to be back.
Yes, happy Merry Christmas New Year to you.
Absolutely. Season's felicitations.
Yeah, you're right. It will be a big year for a lot of sports this year.
It will indeed.
A lot of futures will be decided.
I think so, definitely, I think. Now, just before we start, I just want to say the last podcast we had, we were talking about whether Optus Stadium for the rugby, which was sold out, the Bledisloe Cup, whether they would in fact increase the seating. I'm pleased to say that Rugby Australia got back to me and said they couldn't reply previously because it was being discussed. There will be extra seating put in for that game. So just to confirm, last podcast we said that we hadn't heard, there'd been no reply. They now confirm that there will be extra seating, I believe about 3,000 seats going in.
Oh, it'll be interesting to see where those seats go, because I wouldn't imagine there's too many places where you could put seating that wouldn't obstruct the view of others, but we'll wait and see.
We will indeed. Now, we have, as usual, one guest on the show, and a certain person who should be familiar to many in baseball in Australia, and that is Owen Reid, who spent some time with Baseball Australia and also with the Perth Heat. He's now based in Singapore and is a mobile coach, and we'll hear more about that from Owen later in the show. But, John, am I starting us off?
You are.
Well, I thought, first of all, I want to say I thought the Test series against India in the cricket was fantastic. Really enjoyed it because, to me, we saw some really good cricket from the Indian players. And I think what they showed is if you put your emphasis on Test cricket and you learn to bat and to value your wicket and you have the good technique and you actually have the concentration to let the balls go that are going wide, you will win cricket matches. And I think the thing it highlighted for me was we know in this country now the media, or a lot of sections of the media, are very ill-informed, and they just get on and just pump everybody up and think this is what we as the public want to read. Now, they've been saying how brilliant the Australian bowling attack was, but this showed to me how poor bowling attacks in the world are, because India beat England previously, they've beaten Australia now, two countries that would boast that they've got great bowling attacks. And Australia's bowling attack looked very, very ordinary against the Indian batsmen, who batted really well.
Well, they batted like you expect Test batsmen to bat. Look at Pujara.
He was superb.
And what did he do? He wasn't... Oh, a couple of times he lashed out, but especially once he'd got very good scores under his belt, most notably in Sydney, but... you know, he played a straight bat to everything, didn't he? He left the ones he didn't have to hit, and he hit the ones he should have hit, and blocked the ones he did.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that was good was, I mean, Shane Warne came out and he got criticised by the Australian hierarchy for actually having a pop at the Australian bowlers, and Mitchell Stark, I believe, was most upset when he was saying, I think going into the last test, that Stark had taken 17 wickets in 10 test matches at 47. Hazelwood at the time had 18 wickets at 40, Nathan Lyon 29 at 43, and Cummins 30 at 23. So Cummins was the only one that was really with an average down in the 20s. But you expect your fast bowlers to have averages in the 20s. Spin bowlers usually a little bit higher. But to be fair, your quick bowlers, and it's something I think, yeah, they can get 9-10 jack out, but they can't get the top orders out.
I think Pat Cummins proved he's a very good cricketer, not just a fast bowler, he's a very good cricketer.
His batting was superb.
Yeah, and I thought the one he got out in the Sydney Test in the first innings, you know, he was unlucky to get out to that ball. Would have got a lot better batsman out than him. He's a potential captain of Australia, Pat Cummins.
Yeah, I think he's a very, very good cricketer, and I like watching him bat and bowl.
I do like watching him bowl. I think he's got a lovely action and just looks very, very good. I think he struggles probably at bowling at times because he's got no real backup at the other end. I think Hazelwood was all over the shop. Stark was terrible, to be honest. I mean, they're very good. They're playing Test cricket. These guys aren't mugs. So when we say, oh, he was terrible, it's in relation
it's
to
relative,
how good... Yeah, it's relative to how good he is. And I think he's got some work to do to get back. I think he needs to bowl more. This idea that you've got to wrap your fast bowlers up in cotton wool is proving to be absolute total rubbish. The only way you improve as a bowler is by bowling and bowling and bowling some more. And when you've bowled enough, bowl some more.
Hey, look, we've been saying that, and we had Damien Fleming on previously, who, again, is a big advocate for that.
Oh.
So, yeah, I'm 100% behind you
and
on that one.
When you start looking at some of the workloads of the great bowlers in the past, you realise how important workload is to maintaining form as a bowler.
But it's also to get fitness as well as strength within your body, because bowling is it's not a natural thing to do. So your body needs to be doing a lot of it so that you get that strength and your body gets used to doing it. If you don't do that, that's when you pick up injuries, if you're restricting how much a bowler bowls. And it's been said, and if you look at the players that have gone from Sheffield Shield to Test cricket, they're breaking down because they're not bowling enough.
Let's face it, the key to winning Test matches is taking 20 wickets. The key to winning Tests has always been bowling. If you can't take 20 wickets, it's not going to matter how good your batsmen are. That said, I thought that the bowlers didn't really let the team down. It was the batsmen who let the team down, because when the bowlers did do well, the batsmen didn't back it up.
Yeah, and I mean, that's good, because it leads me into the next point. I mean, there was Fox Sports, and I wrote a piece on the blog, notthefootyshow.com, because the commentary team at Fox, which are all of a certain age, what they were asked, is this the best bowling attack India's ever brought to Australia? Personally, I don't think it was, but I think their batsmen gave them such a great platform that they were able to attack. They bowled very well. Let's not take anything away from them. But the pressure was off them because they had scores, runs on the board that they could then be more aggressive, they could attack more, and they got that success. And let's be fair, as you said there, Australia's batsmen threw their wickets away and did not bat well.
Oh, and I think when you look at some of the batsmen that those previous years Indian attacks have been bowling with, a lot of them were far better players of spin bowling than the blokes we've got out there now.
But you know, you look, I think I looked at, 78, someone criticised me when I wrote that, because, yes, I do understand a lot of the cream of Australian cricket were at World Series cricket at that time when India toured. But they still had some very good bowlers in that side that proved themselves all around the world. But again, if you look at 88 when you had Kapil Dev was there, they had, again, some very, very good bowlers. I mean, even Mahinda Amarnath, who was a part-time bowler, was still a very good bowler.
And how would India, those Indian teams have gone on the roads they produced at Sydney and Melbourne? I mean, they didn't come here and cop those wickets. They were getting good old-fashioned, hard, fast, bouncy Australian wickets. And really, the only wicket that looked anything like an Australian test wicket was here in Perth, and that's the one where India struggled the most. What a surprise. Why do we keep producing roads for visiting teams to come out here and win on?
Yeah, just you were saying you watch Channel 7. I watch Fox with the cricket commentary. I mean, I think one of the things is you get used to what you listen to. You get used to your commentator. So I find it a little bit hard. I found it a little bit boys clubby, the Fox thing. And I, to be honest, I thought Isha Guha, the English girl that they brought in, I thought she was superb. Shane Warne was brilliant. I think he, again, the insights that he gives you are really, really good.
He's got a pretty good cricket brain.
Oh, he's fantastic. I mean, forget what he does away from the pitch. Yep. I think he was superb. Adam Gilchrist, again, I thought made some really good insights. I think he needs a bit of a voice coach, because I find his voice quite hard to listen to. But the rest of them, to be honest, you could put in the bin as far as I'm concerned. Mark Waugh is not a commentator. Brendan Julian, maybe a host, but again, not a commentator. How many times he tells you about the pitch or the weather, it just gets very boring.
Yeah. And Channel 7, I don't give one hoot about whether you show, whether it's your number one channel or your number two channel or whatever channel you want to call it, leave it on the channel. Why do we have to switch and swap around because you want to show the news? Pick a channel, stick with the channel, and show the cricket there.
That's it's obviously all. Because it worked for them during the Olympics, where they just bounced around all the time.
It is so irritating. The only people that care about the 7-0 channel being the primary, your network flagship, are you. The viewers don't give a toss. We couldn't care less. So just stop swapping it around all over the place. Anyway, back to the cricket. Let's talk about Australia's batsmen, just quickly.
Okay.
And I think the selectors have to take some, and administrators have to take some blame here. Aaron Finch is a test opener. The bloke's been sold down. Aaron Finch is a very good cricket player. He's very good. He knows the game. You listen to him when he talks on TV about it and stuff, and when they have him out in the field and they chat. He's a good cricketer. He was sacrificed, and now they've dumped him. If he was going to be playing test cricket, he should have been at six, not at opening. Then you the selections were all over the shop, absolutely, and that had as much effect on the team's performance as anything.
But you wonder what was said to him. Now, it may have been that they're going, we're looking for an opening batsman. Are you prepared to open? Because if you remember, I'm trying to think what year it was. Derek Randall opened the batting for England on a tour of Australia.
Yeah.
Derek Randall was definitely not an opening batsman. It absolutely destroyed his career average. He had a horror time opening the batting. But again, England had a problem with an opening batsman. They asked him if he was prepared to do it, and he said, if you're being asked to play for your country, he goes, you'll do whatever they ask you.
Yeah, I don't blame Aaron.
And that's
Aaron
why
Finch.
He did. And I'm sure Aaron Finch probably did exactly the same. He wanted to play for Australia. He wanted to give the best he could and try to do that. And he probably did. But I think I agree with you. It's very hard to sacrifice the guy when he's come in to try and help you out and in an unfamiliar position.
Absolutely. And I think they got a lot of selections wrong during the tournament. Stark should have probably been dropped for the last test, no doubt. Because he just wasn't bowling well enough, unfortunately, for him and for us too, because when he's on fire, he's almost unplayable, that bloke.
Now, just quickly before we wrap up the cricket, I mean, Ricky Ponting came out during the Test series saying that Stephen Smith will no doubt be back as captain one day. I put something on our Facebook page asking people, should Stephen Smith be allowed to come back as captain after he served his suspension? Unanimously, I think there was only one person said yes, and every other person said, by all means, he can come back in the team, but he should never captain Australia again. Your views? I don't think he should.
Well, it might get to a situation where they've got no choice.
Yeah, but I still think...
I mean, what's interesting, though, is a form of Cameron Bancroft. I mean, he's come back to playing recently in the Big Bash, and not much happened in his first innings, but since then he's gone bang, bang, bang. They'll be screaming out for him to get back into the side. Regardless of what people thought of the efforts of the players that were brought in to open the innings in his absence and the absence of Dave Warner. I mean, essentially you're talking 1, 2 and 4, aren't you?
Yeah, and I think with Justin Langer's connection and the fact that Langer was at the airport when Bancroft came back from South Africa, he knows that player really, really well, and he will know that if he gives him that opportunity, Bancroft will do everything possible to support Langer.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think that'll come back. Do you think we'll ever see Warner back in the side?
I hope we do.
I'm not sure we're going to be honest. I know everyone's saying, yeah, he'll be back. I just think he's been hung out to dry, and I don't think the players, I'm getting the feeling that the rest of the players do not want him back. And I don't think we'll see him back in a test.
Well, I think the rest of the players then should stick their hands up as well and take some of the blame for it all, because there's no way the bowlers didn't know something was going on with the ball, is there?
No, of course. Look, John, I 100% agree, but I think Warner is going to be made the scapegoat. I think because of his age and all of that, they will cast him off.
Oh.
And I feel for the guy to some extent. I don't condone, again, his behaviour as some of the things he's done, but I just think anyone that's made a scapegoat when there were more than one or two involved is a little bit harsh.
I think he should be back in the team. If he's playing well enough cricket, I don't think any of these guys, just because the band's end, should be sent back into the team. I think we've seen Cameron Bancroft proving at the moment that he's in form, so maybe he can come straight back in. But I think Warner and Smith have got to prove their form before they're allowed back into the team. But that should be the same with any player who's been out of the game for 12 months for whatever reason. Injury, taking a rest, suspension, prove your form and you're in. And, you know, gee, they've gone after Warner, haven't they? They were all loving Dave Warner before that series. Everybody was talking about how remarkable he was and his maturity, etc., etc. You know, only takes one donkey, mate, doesn't it? And you've got that reputation forever.
And donkeys can kick.
Yes, they can. Oh, dear. Should we get to the interview?
I think we should.
I'm Caitlin Bassett, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show. And as we mentioned, one guest on this show, our first for 2019, And we're very pleased to welcome back a man who spent some time in Perth working at the Perth Heat and also with Baseball Australia. As I mentioned, he's now based in Singapore and he's running mobile coaching clinics where he's coaching players of all ages throughout the Asian region and, in fact, wherever he's required. And I'm talking about Owen Reid. Owen Reid, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
Ashley, thank you for having me. It's good to be on here with you.
Well, it's been a while since we had a chat, and I think that was the last time was when you were involved with the Australian baseball over here. And since then, you've been travelling the world, and now Singapore is home. You've been busy, though, in that time.
Yes, I have, Ashley. Thankfully, baseball has allowed me to stay busy and has, again, created some pretty unique opportunities. So, as you mentioned, Singapore is home and has been now for going on 5 years ever since I left Perth. And it's a lovely place to call home, a beautiful spot to connect with the rest of the world. And fortunately, that's what I've been able to do as I've created my own business under my own name, Reid Baseball. And it's allowed me to travel throughout the Middle East, Southeast Asia, Europe, and even back to Australia.
Well, before we talk about your company, I saw you also had a spell with the national basketball team in Austria. And it's not a country that you immediately associate with baseball, but, I mean, what's their program like over there?
And like in most places, baseball is growing. You know, it's a place that I played a decade ago. It was my first international stint, Vienna, Austria. And it was an opportunity to go back and continue to help those guys who are passionate about playing the game and continuing to learn. And as a member of the coaching staff, which I'm still currently on since 2017, it's been great to be able to influence some guys that I played against or played with, but also the generation that was before me when I was there who was getting excited and learning about baseball and all that it can create. So it is certainly a sport that's on the rise in Austria. It'll never compete with soccer. Like most countries in baseball, they play second fiddle to soccer at a minimum. But in the grand scheme of things, there's a large pool of kids and grown men even who play baseball in Austria. And that's exciting to obviously allow people who are interested and passionate about the game continue to play it.
Now, if I remember rightly, you came across to Australia at a time when the American Baseball League had a heavy investment in the league here and was looking to develop it. And obviously, you've seen that there's an opportunity in Asia to really develop the game.
That is correct. I was in Australia from 2010 until 2014, so right in the prime of the new version of the Australian Baseball League when, as you mentioned, Major League Baseball had its stake in it. And that was tons of fun. You know, the Perth Heat gave me my first taste of international professional baseball at that level, and both from an administration standpoint and then as a coach, couldn't have had a better, more enriching experience. So from that standpoint, I got to see things through a different lens. And you're right, it allowed me to be closer to Asia. And then when an opportunity came to shift to Singapore and run the academy that I did here for 2.5 years, I jumped at it. And from there, of course, the baseball world continues to shrink and we have opportunities to meet people and establish relationships. And then those have now allowed me to springboard into doing what I do now.
Well, you mentioned the baseball world shrinking, but that's a good thing because it means that the game is actually growing. And I presume, looking at the video clip I saw you post, you've been a busy guy. I mean, you've been to a lot of countries in the last year with your mobile coaching service. Now, how did that come up, the idea that maybe you needed to be a guy who was available to move and help people wherever they were needed?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I have to say from the outset that none of it would be possible if I didn't have the supporting cast, and that cast currently is one person, that's my wife. So if Haley, who is a WA girl herself, if she wasn't okay with me bouncing around the world and playing and, you know, playing and coaching baseball, then then I certainly wouldn't be able to do what I do. So it goes without saying that she's been the driving force behind me being able to do such a thing. But more to your point, the reality is actually that Singapore is so close to so many places, and there's a large group in a lot of major cities, a large expatriate group, where you have quite a dense population of Americans or North Americans, and even various nationalities that also are interested in or play baseball. So I felt like after having been in the region for just over 2 years, I felt like there was a presence and a service that was desired to be able to do what it is that I do, which is coach baseball and motivate young people predominantly to love baseball and continue to play it and encourage them to continue to stay with the sport because it's given me so much. I know that there's opportunities out there for everyone. So knowing that that was, I suppose, a void that needed to be filled, I felt that it was a great opportunity for me to continue doing what I'm doing, be able to pay the electricity bills and still get to do what I love a lot, which is travel and see the world. And so being able to combine baseball with my passion for traveling and getting into new cultures and experiencing new things, it was a no-brainer. And once I got a little bit of momentum and developed some traction, it hasn't slowed since.
Well, they always say any business, the first year is the toughest, but I would have thought being a baseball coach who's available to go wherever he's needed, how do you get the word out there to let people know that service is available?
Well, as I mentioned, the baseball community continues to shrink. And so with one person, you meet three or four others, and you quickly establish those positive relationships, and you kind of filter through the people who are in it for the right reasons and have good intentions. So first and foremost, establishing that relationship. And then again, once I realized that there was an opportunity, I decided to move ahead. I created a website, which is just readbaseball.com, R-E-I-D, baseball. And from there, you know, I'm starting to get a little bit more active on social media through Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. And so being in a position to have platforms where people can go to, so it's not he said, she said, or someone having to have a conversation with me, there's a little bit of a sample size of experiences, and whether it be recommendations, testimonials, or just seeing some of the hard facts and reading someone's biography or seeing photographs or video evidence of what it is that they're seeking.
Now, you know, you've had experience, obviously, as a player, as an administrator, as a coach. Again, as the game is growing, are you finding that you're being asked for advice or guidance beyond just the coaching side of things?
100%. And frankly, that's a part of it that I really enjoy. I never really expected that would be the case, but I do relish those opportunities because I realize that they give people more than just the safe, the out, the ball, the strike, this is how you catch or throw or swing. It's beyond baseball, and it is so much more. And my mantra is life lessons through baseball. That's one of the many things that I pride myself on that I feel separates me from a lot of other coaches or programs out there is that, yes, love to win, love to compete and give kids opportunity to experience success, and all of that will come in due time. But ultimately, what I'm doing, and I feel a big part of my responsibility as a coach, is to teach and prepare young people for what's ahead, what's after baseball. And so being able to teach life lessons through baseball is something that I'm proud of and that I take pride in. So being able to weave in learning opportunities and teach kids in moments on the field or in practice where the application can be taken straight away and applied to something that they may experience at home, in society, at school, in a relationship, in a friendship, or even in their family. So to give you a little bit of an anecdote, in fact, I just got off the phone with a gentleman in Africa whose son I had coached previously in Southeast Asia, and he wanted to talk a little bit about the college recruiting process and, you know, starting that process and just so being a sounding board and just someone that can offer advice from experience, but also from the knowledge and the research and be able to help people in that kind of way, because so many before me were the mentor or the person that allowed me to learn that and experience it firsthand.
It's one of the aspects, having sort of, you know, looked at your website, that I find really interesting, because I do feel today in the sporting landscape, there is obviously this drive for everybody wants to play at the elite level. They all want to play professionally in the Major League Baseball or for their country. And yet we all know the reality is a very, very small percentage will do that. So I think what you're doing is producing more rounded individuals that will enjoy the sport rather than just focusing purely on the sport aspect. And it seems to me that a lot of coaches have forgotten that today. Do you feel that having looked at other sports and no doubt done your homework?
I do tend to agree. You know, we're at a unique time in the game of baseball where it's such a global game. It's played in all corners of the world at all levels, and that's a beautiful thing. And I think that as coaches, part of our responsibility is to never lose sight of the fact that it is still a game and it should be fun. And so if I'm instructing a young person individually or in a small group or in a team, all of which I do with my business, it's my job, it's my responsibility. I'm accountable for that experience to be fun. And if they're not enjoying it, then they won't want to come back. And if they don't want to come back, well, then I've not done what I need to do to make sure that that's an enriching, fulfilling experience for them. So I think on a much broader scale, you know, and at every level, of course, it's different. And as you get closer to the top and you reach the pinnacle of the sport, that being Major League Baseball, you look at some guys in the game now who are adults, grown men, who are still out there smiling, laughing, having fun, poking fun with their teammates while still taking the game seriously because it's their job, it's their livelihood. So I think never losing sight of the fact that it is a game, it should be fun, and if we as coaches can allow that to take place, then we've done a good job.
I totally agree with that. I mean, one thing I'm thinking must be kind of difficult with what you're doing now in this mobile coaching is you're coaching all ages and all experience levels is probably, I suppose, tempering your coaching to suit the standard or the age group that you're being asked to coach.
That's been one of the bigger adjustments that I've gone through as a coach and as a person generally is connecting with and then relating to the individual and not having a cookie cutter approach, not having a one size fits all approach to what I'm doing, if it's skill based or even if it's just conversational. So first establishing that trust and that confidence from the player, from the person to me, so that there is a connection immediately and striking common ground, being approachable, being open, being honest and super transparent allows for those things to take place in a much more timely fashion. And so more to exactly what you brought up, which is dealing with a 6-year-old or a 36-year-old and then everywhere in between, it's been challenging, yet it's really forced me to grow and develop as a person, which there's no price tag that you can put on that. So from my standpoint, as much as I'm teaching someone or a group of people, I'm learning at the same time. And so just having an open mind to everyone as individuals, getting to know them as a person. And then once I get to know them as a person, then I can work with them as an athlete. But if I'm just working with them as an athlete and I don't get to know them, that connection is going to be minimal, if not non-existent.
Just looking at the region that you're working in, which is predominantly Asia, I mean, it is an area where the game definitely seems to be growing. We're seeing, you know, the Australian Baseball League now having links to Asia, which I think can only be a good thing in the long term. Do you think we're going to see down the track maybe an Asian league?
Well, there are leagues that exist in the major baseball playing countries in Asia, those being Japan, Korea, Taiwan. And those leagues play obviously a very good brand of baseball, very competitive baseball, where many times players from North America who've had experience in affiliated organizations will take a turn to play in those leagues and will kind of maybe finish their career or rejuvenate who they are as players and then return to North America. One of those guys right now is in fact Warwick Sopel, who's from Perth, homegrown guy.
Yep.
And is going to be playing in Korea if I'm not wrong. So looking at something like that, it's obviously a very popular sport in the region. The places that I've gone so far are much more grassroots than that. Places like Bangladesh, places like Saudi Arabia, places like Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, those places aren't exactly known for baseball and competitive baseball at that. So the opportunity in Asia and, you know, shifting into the Middle East as well, those opportunities are obviously substantial where you have an interest, but those places don't always have access to a high level of coaching or someone who's willing to go there and provide the level of instruction and personal attention to their needs.
Now, if anybody wanted to get in touch, I believe you're pretty busy for the next 6 months, but if, you know, anyone hears this and feels they want to call you in and have you help, is it best to just contact you through the website?
Absolutely, yes. People can get in touch if they would like to work together, or if they just want to say good day and have a chance to exchange information via email. So I am accessible on my website or also my social media platforms on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. They can find me at The Reed Baseball. So that's just The Reed Baseball.
Fantastic. Well, Owen, it's great to catch up with you again, and I'm so pleased to hear that you're thriving up there and you're enjoying what you're doing, and you're also basically hopefully making better people and better baseballers in your work. But congratulations, and great to catch up.
Ashley, thank you for having me, and likewise, my friend, continue to do great things and keep having fun.
Hi, I'm Willie Miller, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you're indeed listening to the podcast of Not the Footy Show, and that was Owen Reed, who is running The Reed Baseball. And if you want to go to his website, it's reedbaseball.com, and you can find out more about his coaching and his mobile coaching that he's available to come to you and run clinics, whether it's for children or for senior teams as well. And the one thing, John, I loved that Owen said in that interview, it's got to be fun. At whatever level you're playing, you've got to be enjoying playing sport, because that's what it's about.
It is about fun, and there's no other reason to do it other than enjoyment. Really, is there?
Nah. You know, I mean, there's nothing I enjoy more than seeing top international players who really love it when they're out there, and they enjoy it, and they've got a big smile when they score a goal. Brian Habana, you could always tell in rugby, loved playing, and it was a joy when he played it. And they're the ones that inspire me, even though I'm an old fart now and can't play, but I'm like, oh man, I can do that, you know.
Oh, I don't know, you could still play. We could squeeze you into the Divi 4 over 50s down at Freo, mate. You can wield a stick if you like.
Well, your co-host from the reverse seat keeps inviting me to walking hockey. I think I'm still young enough to actually run. I'm very insulted by that.
Well, let's get on, shall we? The Olympics. Where's it going? What's it doing? Why do we have it? And should we care?
My view is, I think the Olympics, and I may be slightly wrong with this, I think it's dying. I wonder if it's relevant anymore, in that I think we just give so many medals away that the kudos of an Olympic medal, or even now if you look at the amount of athletes that go to an Olympics, is it quite as exclusive as it used to be? And I don't think it is anymore. And on a sheer commercial point of view, you've got to look at the cost. Now, if Japan's gone over budget by the amount they have,
well, it's a projected budget of $7 billion, and now it's $22 billion or something.
Yeah,
like that,
and I mean, in Japan, let's be honest, they're usually really good at stuff like this.
Money.
Yeah, but managing things like that and getting things absolutely correct. Now, if they've gone over budget, trust me, half the other countries. I mean, I can't see Paris coming in on budget. Los Angeles, I don't think so.
Well, when they won the rights to this tournament, they said, oh yeah, $7 billion will cover it. Now, X years later, and still 18 months away from the games, it's 20-odd billion. So by the time Los Angeles comes around, how much do you reckon they're going to have to? Is it going to be $70 billion to put the infrastructure in place? I mean, admittedly, they'll have certain bits of infrastructure there that perhaps Japan or other countries wouldn't have, but it's all going to have to be upgraded anyway, and they're going to have to build new facilities, and they're going to have to, you know, blah 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 blah. Is it becoming too expensive? I mean, and what is the future for sports that rely on Olympic funding? Because we've seen just recently the AOC and the Australian Sports Commission come out and say, we've had funding cuts for the last 7 years. We need an injection of funds. So at the same time as costs have been rising, their income has been shrinking. So there's a lot of monetary pressure on the AOC and Australian Sports Commission to tighten their belts. So what does that mean for sports How much are they going to have to tighten their belts? Say, in the situation of hockey, the Olympic qualifier is now the Pro League. To get to the Olympics, Australia has to play in the Pro League. Now, the Pro League is a home and away league run over 6 months that will cost a fortune. Is the AOC going to be happy about spending that amount of money to qualify one sport?
But the thing is, John, you said Australia has to do that. They didn't have to. They No. opted to go into the Pro League. They could have gone down the other route with the Hockey Series Open and the Hockey Series Finals, which would have been far less costly.
Oh, a couple of tournaments a year.
Yeah, exactly. So they could have, but they opted to go down that path. And one thing we've got to be very clear about is the Pro League is not going to mean you qualify. The top four will then play off against the Hockey Series Finals winners to decide who goes
so
through.
So being in the Pro League doesn't guarantee anything more than being in the Hockey World Series.
And this is where a lot of people have got very confused with that. But going back to your point about that, I mean, as we know, you've mentioned that we have now the IOC, which is the International Olympic Committee, and then you have all these national committees, which like the AOC, who made millions from hosting the Olympics, and you would have thought that they would have invested that and still have a nice good pot that they can call upon when they need it. I don't think that we need those anymore. I mean, and this is why the Olympics will survive, because there are too many levels now where people have got jobs and are on a good wicket and are enjoying the spoils of those positions. But my argument across the board is, why in all these years now have a lot of these sports not become self-funding? And I think the government needs to turn around to some of them and say, well, hang on a sec, we've given you football is a prime example. How much money since Frank Lowy changed football around, it became the Football Federation of Australia, have the government given football? To me, they should not be giving a cent anymore. They should say, we've given you, and it's over 100 million, I think, overall, if you count the World Cup bid. And say, well, hang on, if you can't be self-sustainable by now, you're never going to be, and we're not going to keep bailing you out. And I just think there has to be now, the onus has to go back on some of these sporting bodies, and they need to become self-sufficient.
Oh, absolutely. And for a lot of these sports, because, you know, there's a lot of sports where they can't afford that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, and they are the ones that need the help to grow their numbers in order to then get to or that's their goal, to become self-sufficient.
And let's face it, hockey's not a professional sport, even though they call it the Pro League. And it's not a professional sport because administrators did nothing for 30 or 40 years. Did literally nothing. They should have opened their eyes up when rugby said, well, we're going to go professional. We're letting go of those shackles and we're going to do it. And hockey hasn't done it. And other sports that would have been capable of doing it haven't done it. It's been so much easier for them to sit on their bums and keep collecting Olympic money than to go out and do what's necessary to create a truly professional sport. And they're still doing it now by pushing us down this Olympic qualification route as the route to funding. They're telling countries that the best way to get money to grow your game is to hit up your local National Olympic Association.
Yeah, I heard that interview with Mike Joyce, who's in charge of development at the FIH with Ernst Barth. Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a crazy thing to be hearing. But the thing you have to look at again is, I'm a big advocate, you have to sometimes go back and look at history to understand why you are where you are. So if you look at the FIH when it was first set up, it was purely to attain Olympic involvement. And so that was their sole focus. And then, of course, when the World Cups came in and the Champions Trophies, suddenly they started running those tournaments. But they tended to leave all the national associations to just do their own thing. Then suddenly they, of course, as the membership came in, and they started gaining more and more control. So, but if you look, that's all they were interested in initially, was keeping hockey in the Olympic Games. And that was it. And presumably, for the reasons you said, that there was funding coming the other way that was supporting their head office at the time.
But overall, what does this mean for the Olympic movement? We've seen sports come in recently like golf. Surfing's going to be at the... And I'm not taking any away from the people that do these activities, right?
You know? Yeah.
Surfing doesn't need the Olympics. Surfing is doing the Olympics a favour by showing up at the Olympic Games. They're already in a position where they can pay their athletes very large sums of money. It's something that a sport like hockey that has 30 million according to the FIH players around the world, we can't afford to pay our players at all. You know, we have to rely on government funding. So, soccer, for instance, under 23s, how does that fit into the Olympics ideal of, you know, excellence? Under 23s, where is the Olympics going to draw a line and say, no, we actually stand for this?
But you know, the funny thing is, John, again, if you go back to the 20s, and when the Olympic movement after the First World War, that's when it started to really get serious about, because the whole idea was it was going to promote peace and unity and all of that. The interesting thing was they didn't want any team sports in the Olympics. That was the original plan. Then for some reason, football snuck in there. And I think it was because, where were the 24 Olympics? Amsterdam. And I think it was because it was going to be in Europe. They wanted football because football was big in Europe, and it was a good way to kind of get that message across. And then hockey kind of snuck in under the radar. And was they were the only two team sports at that time. Now, of course, it's then blown up and got bigger. And I agree with you, like golf, tennis. I mean, the golfers, nobody went really of any worth to play in Rio. Now, you've got the X Games, which is run a lot by the IOC, and that's where they're running all their test sports now to look at whether they should be in the Olympics. Now, you mentioned the new sports, and I did the Asian Games last year. I commentated on that, and they had the rock climbing. Now, I was kind of wondering how that was going to work. That was fantastic to watch. I have to say, it was bloody exciting, really fast, except the relay, there's a few problems. So the relay, the way it works is, you know, you have to climb the face, then you come down on the abseil dam, but the abseil seem to be on a certain speed. So, you know, you're all coming down at the same speed, but it means you don't lose that lead.
Yeah.
But yeah, look, I thought that was good. Is it an Olympic sport? Not in my traditional terms of the Olympics. I would like to see the Olympic Games go back to what were the original sports, and the focus go very much back onto track and field. Cut the swimming back big time, because I just wrote a piece yesterday on the blog. I think there's I forget how many medals there are for swimming at the next Olympics, and it's just hundreds. It's, to me, it's too many.
Oh, and they've released the medals, did you see?
Yeah, they look really good, actually.
Yeah. They'll also send and receive SMSs, I'm led to believe.
Because they're using the gold from the phones, aren't they?
Yeah, they're smashing up a few million phones and
that's how Nokia could make some. It's not Nokia, it was Swedish, wasn't it? Yeah. Or Scandinavian.
But I didn't think that was gold in them anyway.
No, I didn't either.
I'm sure we've done some discussion about this previous, about the fact that the medals aren't actually gold, silver and bronze. They're, you know, alloys.
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
So do you think there's a future for the Olympics? I mean, I just think when we get
I think there's a future for it, but it's got to radically rebuild itself and change what it does. And sports and nations have to change the way that they approach it as well. I think the funding model and the way the funding happens is now turning into a joke. It doesn't work.
Could they make the Olympics and move, for example, make it a truly global event by having, say, the athletics in London, the hockey in Australia, and having various sports being hosted around the world?
I think the beauty of the Olympics is whatever it is, whatever sports are involved in it, is it all happens in the same place. I think the idea of having all those athletes mingling together in the same spot from all the different countries is a great idea. And it does promote peace and harmony and all those things that the Olympic movement wants to
promote. Plenty of love.
Yeah, there's a lot of loving going on, that's for sure. But when you see it being bastardised by, you know, rich American basketballers being able to live on yachts in the harbour and not being forced to stay in the village, well, you're not competing then, mate. Get rid of that stuff.
No, I agree with you.
In the village. That's what it's all about. Then you buy into it. You don't just come along and pretend you're an Olympian and walk home with a medal, mate. You've got to involve yourself in the whole Olympics thing.
And if you talk to any athletes that have been there, and they say the best thing about the village is it is just the athletes. Like,
yeah.
No media are allowed in there.
Yep.
Nobody else is allowed.
It's a free zone.
And I think that in this day and age, that is fantastic. I think that's the way it should be.
And you know what? They should ban all athletes for the duration of being in that village from social media.
Totally agree with that as well.
You're not allowed to use social. You can keep your phones and stuff, but no social media. We're going to block
them. Just give them the old-fashioned phones while they're there.
That's right. Good idea.
In Japan, they could do that easily.
Yeah. They could.
Give them a medal.
I mean, I think it's coming to crunch time for the Olympic movement, and I think they realise it. I think they realise now that no one wants to host the Olympics anymore. because it's just so expensive. The terms and conditions of hosting the Olympics are now restrictive as well on governments. They don't want to be giving up tax revenue. They don't want to be giving away all of this stuff for nothing to corporations. And I think the nexus between the Olympic movement and sponsors has got to change too. I think there's a perception around the world that, you know, that all they're in it for, all the Olympic IOC's in it for, is to get big checks out of Coca-Cola and ANZ or whatever.
And look, FIFA's exactly the same. So yeah, it's not just the IOC. There are other areas as well. Look, I think you're absolutely right. And I think the only person you're going to see bidding probably for 2032 will be India. And I think they'll host the games then.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, Dr. Cuckoo will be happy.
Well, anyway, does that wrap us up for today?
I think it does.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.